here with Dan Kane, who's been the lead investigative reporter for the News and Observer's reporting on the academic and athletic scandals at UNC. Dan, thank you for being with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Jim.
Dan, my guess is that a lot of folks in Chapel Hill may not have heard very much about you before this story broke out. So I might start with that. You are an investigative reporter, not a sports reporter. What have been the other high-profile stories on which you've been the lead reporter before this one?
The one I'm probably best known for is the Jim Black, the scandals in the state house with House Speaker Jim Black. I broke the story about how he had created a job for Michael Decker, the representative who kind of switched parties at the last minute to allow Speaker Black to remain in charge at the House, and then we uncovered all the material showing that his political director, Meredith Norris, had also been working for a company that wanted the lottery business back when the state was trying to figure out if it should have a lottery, and we uncovered records showing that she was involved in helping getting the lottery legislation passed, getting her client, introduced to, members of the House, and, arranging kind of like dinners and stuff like that. And in the end, she also ended up, being convicted of a misdemeanor for violating the state's lobbying law. And as Speaker Black, went to prison for, corruption type thing that I think involved payments from chiropractors under the table, is my recollection. So that's probably the thing I'm best known for. I've been with the paper for 17 years. Started out in Durham city government. Moved down to state government. Actually did those stories when I was a state government reporter, and then moved to the investigative team in 2009.
I think about the work that you're doing, and I'm going to date myself by telling you that I knew Pat Stith when he was a student assistant working in the sports information office over at UNC, and then he went on into being an investigative reporter, and he told me that he was a lot more popular among lots of folks when he was just being a sports reporter than when he got into investigative reporting, because your job is to investigate things that are nearly always injurious to big institutions, big public figures. Many of them obviously don't like you. Do you get used to the idea that you're nearly always vilified by those whose ox you're goring?
Well, that doesn't always happen. I did a series a couple of years ago about stream and wetland reclamation, where there's a state agency that actually, had won national, acclaim for its work. But what I was seeing was that, somewhere in the neighborhood, 20-30% of these projects were having to be, fixed, and that there were projects that really didn't seem to fit the purpose. There were a whole host of issues. And, I remember after that, people were, they basically took my reporting, and there were some changes that were made, and there wasn't really a whole lot of hostility there. I have a lot of respect for those guys, actually. I think they have a hard job, it doesn't always work out that way. But sometimes it does. And, I think in this case, when you talk about college sports, emotions just run high, and you have this tremendous, competition within the triangle between Duke and NC State and Carolina, and everybody's just sort of jumps in, and you have to sort of sort through all of that as you report, and be mindful of when some of this is emotional versus factual.
Well, let's get on into that, Dan, on the UNC controversy. Let's start with just a little technical thing that I'd called you about a few days ago. I want to start with what Roy Williams actually said was his response to the discussion about paper classes. He said in that ESPN interview These are Roy's words. I thought that meant that a class was on paper, but it didn't really exist. And then I come to find out people are using that terminology, paper classes, to signify independent study courses that you do papers. Dan, I confess that I'm not sure that it had been clear to me whether that term, classes, paper classes, phony classes, have all meant to me that the students didn't have to do anything. I would say that you probably spent more time than anyone outside UNC on this question. Is there a difference, or are we simply all talking about independent studies courses where only there's a paper at the end of the term, but no classes are required?
Well, the argument is that these lecture-style classes, and that's what they were advertised as, okay, in the registration section there at the university, and the student, you know, the course catalogs, you know, those are advertised as lecture classes, okay? In other words, there's a classroom, there are assignments, you know, there could be a test or papers, but, you know, a syllabus, you know, all of that is what you would find with a lecture-style class. That's how they were advertised. But what had happened was these classes were turned into a quote-unquote independent study, okay, which meant there was no class time, which apparently meant there was no syllabus. And what typically happened, from what we've seen here, is that you know, a student would have to basically come up with a topic and write a paper, and turn in the paper at the end. You know, the records show that, you know, the grades were on average between like a B+ and an A-. So were the papers read? There's a lot of question about that. Governor Martin said that he doubted that happened in a lot of cases. You know, when you look at the grades that you know, we have seen, you know, compared to what some of these athletes are doing, because what right now all we've seen here so far is you know, athletes' grade information. You know, they're not doing very well in much of anything else, but they're scoring, you know, B+ and A- and A's in these classes. So, was there work done? Apparently, a paper was turned in. Now we've seen a couple of cases where, you know, the paper had a lot of plagiarism in it. So that's where you get to the question of, you know, is the work being done? And then, of course, you know, Rashad McCants is saying that, you know, well, he didn't even write the papers. You know, tutors were doing it for him. And, you know, that's a lot broader than, you know, the information that surfaced out of, you know, the initial, you know, investigation when the NCAA came to town over the football team. You know, some of the players having, you know, being kind of, you know, schmoozed by agents and their runners, and which led to the discovery that there was a tutor who was providing, you know, additional help to some of these players. But I don't remember, you know, her in her case that she was, you know, wholesale writing papers. It was more along the lines of, you know, doing footnoting, doing bibliographies, maybe rewriting some passages. You know, we saw some of that, I think, not all of that, but there was some indication of, you know, tutors doing, you know, more than what they should. Also, when we got some emails from the university showing this cozy relationship between, you know, Dr. Nangoro and the advisors on the academic support program for athletes, you know, there was a tutor who had sent off to Debbie Crowder, you know, topics for these papers, you know, and it looked like, you know, she had written them. You know, well, that presumably was something that the athletes should be doing. So there's some, you know, while what Rashad McCants is saying is, you know, really ramps it up quite a bit with regard to the tutor involvement, there are indications here that tutors were doing more than they should have, and not just, you know, Jennifer Wiley. So, you know, I imagine that's something that Ken Weinstein is looking at, you know, as part of his investigation.
You know, Dan, it's it may not be it may not matter at this point, but in trying to fix responsibility, trying to put each of these questions into separate buckets is particularly challenging for those of us who have not lived in that world full time. First of all, I think we have, if Nangoro has said that a class, if a class is listed as a lecture class but is then actually delivered as a independent studies course, that's probably fraud. It is certainly it's certainly not true. But if the independent studies courses, if the professor himself wishes to say that he made a judgment that it was an A paper, it's sort of hard to find for. It's kind of hard ultimately to do more than find subjective fault with him on that. So then you've got the question of plagiarism, and the plagiarism of the papers is kind of a completely separate responsibility.
Wait a minute. I mean, Jim, you're forgetting something here. Some of these classes had no professor at all. I mean, Debbie Crowder was just setting these up.
Okay, I think that's what we're trying to get at.
There was no professor involved in a number of these classes. It was just Debbie, providing this opportunity. I mentioned before, you know, the tutor that sends the topics to Debbie for a couple of classes, one of which was listed as a no-show, the other wasn't. And in fact, it now looks like that class was a no-show. It was one that everybody missed. We found it because we had gotten the emails, the correspondence showing. Think about that. This tutor is sending topic ideas to Debbie Crowder, not to a professor. And she's asking Debbie to approve them. Debbie is not a professor.
Right.
Okay.
Which tutor
who works for the academic support program for athletes, or who did. Okay.
Which tutor was that?
I think her name was Susie Durr. I hate to be held to that because this is a while since I wrote that story. What's the explanation for that? You know, how do you say that that's legitimate? How do you say that, you know, when you've got a class that does not involve, there's no evidence of a professor being involved in that class, how do you say that's legitimate? And I think that one of the big questions with what's happened in the last few days is, you know, we're now seeing evidence that basketball players were in these classes in large numbers. And some of them may have been ones that, you know, a professor, you know, Dr. Nyangoro was involved. But some of them could have been ones where they're just, somebody went straight to Debbie. How do you justify that? How do you not see that when you've got an athlete who's not going to class for Rashad was something like, what was it? It was more than 10 of these things. How do you not notice that?
Who do you believe was trying to justify it, Dan?
What? You mentioned what Roy was saying about, you know, I thought these were, you know, what you just read, you know, that he said,
yeah,
well,
I thought people were talking about
a paper class as being a class that there was no work involved. But he's saying, well, but these classes had work involved. Well, what, you know...
Yeah, I'm not sure that I heard Roy say attempt to justify it. I thought that he tried to distance himself from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to talk to Roy about this. We would like to talk to, you know, folks on the athletic side about, you know, these classes and you know, how many of them, you know, athletes were taking and what was the explanation, you know, for...
Has Roy been inaccessible to you?
Well, yeah, we haven't been able to talk to Roy. We obviously did try to reach him Friday. I'm pretty sure it was my colleague Andrew Carter who made the request, and I'm pretty sure we were turned down. We were given a statement.
Has the athletic department, have the coaches generally been accessible to you during your reporting of the story?
No.
And you've tried?
Yes.
Steve Kirshner is, in my experience with him, is a straight-up guy. What does Steve tell you about the coaches not being willing to be interviewed about this?
I think you'd have to ask Steve that. I mean, if you want to get into a conversation with Steve about, you know, how responsive they've been, you know, that's fine. But I don't, you Now, I don't feel like that's, you know, we have reached out to them numerous times to want to talk to the coaches, to the various people up in the department, and we've had very few opportunities throughout this whole thing.
Let's go back to Rashad McCants for just a moment. When McCants said that the AFAM classes he took not only didn't require him to attend class, but that the required end-of-term paper was written by others for the elite players of his era, then a group of elite players was among those who showed up in support of Roy for that ESPN interview that was done by Jay Billis. Do you believe McCants or the players who said that he was lying?
I would like to talk to the players, okay? I mean, it's just that simple, you know? I mean, let's talk to the players. Let's ask them, how many classes were you in that did not meet? And how did you get in those classes? And what were you told you were supposed to do for those classes? And who did you talk to within the athletic department about these classes? That's what should be happening here. I mean, I understand that off-camera, athletes, not by name, I mean, Jay Billis didn't tell us, like, well, this basketball player said this, and that basketball player said that, and we have no idea. I don't know if Jay asked them, well, how many classes were you of this type were you in? You know, and how did you get in them? And you know, what kind of work did you do? We just don't know that from them. You know, it's what we have from them is very scant. It's not on camera, or it's not even, I don't even see a quote in, you know, ESPN's report, a direct quote from any one of them. It's very, you know, kind of vague. So, you know, I would like to talk to them. You know, I tried to reach out to them, in the weeks leading up to, you know, ESPN report and our story. It's very hard to, you know, the ones that I was successful in reaching a family member or they'll leave a message of some sort. I mean, I just didn't hear back from any of them.
Did you find it of interest or significant that Jay Billis, who I respect, I think Jay is widely respected as a no-nonsense reporter. I think he has a law degree. He's seems to be straight up, for heaven's sakes. And of course, he played at Duke. He said that he believed that Roy was telling the truth. Do you find that significant?
Yeah, you know, I mean, Jay is—he's a very bright, very knowledgeable, very sharp guy. He's been critical of the NCAA. You know, he had a really significant story. I might have tweeted it or something. I can't remember exactly how it came out, but he was a guy who basically said, "Look, I can go on NCAA's website right now and order up jerseys for all these, you know, these athletes who don't get a dime for them." You know, it was something like that. You know, so. So, you know, Jay, I mean, he's not a guy who's just sort of like, you know, that you would just say is like sort of drinking the Kool-Aid. But having said that, you know, I mean, I would have liked for, you know, somebody who's done a lot of time in, you know, journalism, you know, doing investigative reporting, you know, handling that interview. You know, just because, you know, investigative reporters, they tend to, you know, focus on, you know, the details, have people kind of walk through the process and tend to get a richer explanation as to what happened. And so that's my only thing I thought of when I heard this thing about, you know, the players just, you know, in a very vague sense saying that what Rashad said wasn't true without really any explanation about, well, what specifically were their experiences. Okay, so there's my two cents.
Our reports are that Mary Willingham has suggested that she believes, and I'm not sure that she's offered proof of it, but that she believes, based on the trends that she saw, that the academic problems seem to be worse, or this particular kind of problem may have started or may have gotten worse when Matt Doherty was the coach. And even Willingham has said that she thinks that Roy Williams had tried to rein them in. Do you have any insight into that through what you have come across?
First of all, I really don't know. I mean, you know, one of the things that would really help the public's understanding of what happened here is seeing the basketball enrollments in these classes for as far back as that information is available, which would be 1994. Okay? As you probably know, we have sued to get that information, and we've been denied so far. The university has, you know, brought up the Federal Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. You know, judge looked at, you know, some an enrollment record that does exist that provides some of this information, and determined that yes, he could identify, you know, one of the athletes, and that there was like a 1 in 4 chance of identifying another, and therefore none of it is being made public. I would argue that, you know, there should be a way to negotiate so that, okay, if there's a chance that you know, one of these athletes could be identified, okay, you know, we can work so that that doesn't happen, but at least we have, you know, that enrollment information to have some idea, you know, about the athletic involvement. And you know, that's one thing that would help, you know, tremendously here. And I just say that in response to, you know, all this talk about, like, well, I think this might have happened when somebody was, you know, when this person came in or when that person came in. I mean, there are some ways to help really kind of, you know, pinpoint this. We have made all kinds of requests and, you know, to try to do that, and we've been, rebuffed in a number of ways. As far as Roy goes, you know, the one thing I will say, and we've written about this, is that, you know, towards the end of 2006, faculty at the University of North Carolina, they become aware of a huge scandal at Auburn University, okay? And this was a sociology professor that was in 1 year alone, he offered something like over 200 independent studies. The New York Times, an excellent reporter there, Pete Samuel, I think he's now with Sports Illustrated, you know, broke that story. People here read it, and they started asking, we don't have anything like that here, do we? Okay? And those concerns made their way to the faculty athletic committee. And you can see the minutes where it's being discussed. And in subsequent meetings, you know, what they're told is, no, we don't see a problem here. But they also say, you know, Robert Mercer, who then ran the academic support program for student athletes, they said to Robert, well, you know, you track it and let us know. There was, from what I understand, never anything produced from Mr. Mercer since then. Okay? What happens at the same time is those independent studies out of the AFAM department start to drop significantly, okay? And the no-show classes continue, but they start tailing off, and then particularly they tail off in 2009 when Debbie Crowder retires. Some still get arranged, most notably the one from 2011, you know, the summer of 2011 that Dr. Nyangoro set up at the last minute for a bunch of football players. So what's interesting about all that is all of this happened and the public didn't know anything about it. And you have to ask why. You know, why did all this happen? And yet nobody seems to know why it happened.
Are you saying why it happened then or
why it happened then? Why did those independent studies drop from somewhere in the neighborhood of, I'm sorry, I'm going to get this wrong because I don't have the numbers in front of me, but from the hundreds to, you know, 50, 60 out of that department. Why did the no-show classes start tailing off? You know, there are a couple different explanations out there for why the basketball team got out in 2009. One is because Debbie Crowder retired. The other is because the counselors changed for the
Wayne Walden. What about Wayne Walden's role in all of this? His departure in 2009 has been cited as significant in all this. What do you think?
It could be. I mean, it coincides with the basketball players out of AFAM. Now, the other thing that's interesting in all this is the basketball players really it's not the right word to say they stopped taking AFAM because, the basketball team was pretty heavily involved in AFAM for a good number of years, right up through the championship team of 2004 and 2005. But then you start seeing fewer athletes going to the AFAM major. The explanation from Steve Kirshner was that, these subsequent athletes had different interests. And I think Roy made that suggestion at a news conference back in, I think it was late, the start of the 2012-2013 season. That was in response to questions I had, because I was asking, why were they out of AFAM? Why were they out of these classes? Now, I guess that's possible that the subsequent basketball players had different interests. But now we're seeing what happened in the earlier part of the decade with the heavy involvement, and now this evidence emerging that a lot of the AFAM classes they were taking didn't meet, and we're aware of this episode in late 2006 where these red flags are starting to be raised about independent studies, and did somebody get worried and say we better start just kind of quietly getting out of this? And that's a lot of people have started to surmise that.
If that is the case, Dan, would that not be something that they should be? We should find virtuous rather than something that would be that we would find somehow problematic. Cleaning up something that they found in the past would seem to me to be on the side of the angels. And then I suppose the notion of trying to cover up what happened before might have many motives. But first of all, trying to clean it up is a good idea, isn't it?
Sure, as long as you acknowledge that's what you've done. Have you seen that?
Well,
I'm just asking, have you seen it? I mean, has anybody told you that, we realized there was a problem here and we needed to fix it?
Well, I realize that a lot of what we're saying here, first of all, most of my questions are based on things that we're trying to figure out, and you have done, and your job, of course, is to look for the facts, but then also we have opinions about all this, and when I can't quite figure out someone's actions, I try to connect the dots by wondering what their motives are. You shouldn't start off by questioning motives in the beginning, but if we don't understand the actions, then I think it's reasonable. What's your own assessment of why UNC would, when it is very clear that the NNO is not going away, that in previous eras perhaps you could dodge and feint and duck questions like this, but when it's pretty clear that you're not going away and that the NNO is not going away, why would UNC, you think, go to such lengths to make it so difficult to get information on things that happened long before the current administration got here?
You're just kind of heading into, sort of conjecture that, people who are paid to have an opinions and fans and, people who are interested in this issue can have. All I can tell you is that, we've had a number of episodes where, we've really had to fight to get information. The Julius Peppers transcript episodes, one in particular, we came across this transcript. It looked like evidence that the scandal was going much farther back than the university had, pinpointed or had been able to report at that point. We had given them, the contact of a graduate who had been in a class, who was not an athlete, who had been in a class in 2005. Had provided emails, showing how that this class really was a sham, and gave them to the university. They were not going to pursue it, and I was baffled by that. I was baffled by their refusal to really look at, you know, what I had found and what had, you know, come to me. You know, that's probably one of the more, you know, better known episodes of this, but, you know, let's talk about the emails I talked about earlier, the cozy relationship, you know, between, you know, Nangoro and the counselors in that academic support program. We had requested that, you know, it took about a year for those emails to come our way. And there's other examples like this. Now, in some cases, they've been prompt with information, but in others, you know, in a good number of others, they haven't. It took something like 6 months just to get a contract for, you know, somebody they'd hired to do, you know, PR for them. You know, it takes a long time when we make these requests for the correspondence between them and the NCAA. I can't, you know, it's hard to get in somebody's head and understand, you know, why they are doing what they're doing, you know. But so, like I said, you know, folks can, you know, that's something that folks who are paid to have an opinion, you know, folks who care about this issue, you know, they can talk about it. It's kind of hard for me to you know, put forward an explanation.
I'm wondering how much has changed in the last week. John Drescher, who's your editor, wrote back in May that he thought that this story had boiled down to three basic questions. One, how did the classes get no-show classes get started? Who knew about the no-show classes? And the three, what did they do when they knew about the classes? He implied, didn't say directly, that if you got answers to those questions, that the coverage might abate. Was that an accurate assumption of maybe what he was saying? And I'm wondering if the McCant story in the last week, all of this changes that.
Well, I mean, I'm a little confused by your question because, I mean, you know, if the answers are provided, then obviously, you know, the story naturally kind of reaches a conclusion and you know, we can, you know, and you move on. I mean, that's natural for just about any story. When things kind of get solved, when we have a clear explanation of what all happened, you know, you do tend to just gravitate, you know, move on to the next story. I think those are very reasonable, you know, questions to be answered here. So, you know, and obviously, you know, with Rashad McCants and also with the data that, you know, Mary Willingham gave us, you know, we now have kind of opened up, you know, sort of a new door. You know, one that I think people suspected, you know, all along, you know, and that has to do with the heavy involvement, you know, within the basketball program in these classes. You know, so hopefully, you know, now that door is open, and obviously, you know, it looks like, you know, Ken Weinstein is digging into that, you know, that aspect of this whole matter. You know, we'll get some answers. You know, we might get a clear understanding about, you know, the three questions that John asked in his column. You know, we'll see.
And maybe this question, and you've been generous with your time, we'll wrap up here. The kind of final view about all this has to do with whether the Carolina is different. I'm not sure that it's relevant to the story, but it certainly is discussed when you ask around. Carolina, for years, rightly or wrongly, has had an image of holding itself to a higher standard. The Carolina way was talked about a lot. And I think this university and students, which would include athletes and non-athletes, have always sort of, there have been some who've chosen an easiest possible route to graduation. Would you say that, and I'm not sure that there's a good answer to this, but do you have a sense, is UNC different from other schools, and other D1 schools, big schools in this regard?
I mean, you know, as you pointed out at the beginning of our, you know, interview here, you know, I'm not a sports reporter, so I've not done, you know, investigations of other programs, you know, to learn, you know, like how they operate, what they do right, what they do wrong. Obviously, in the course of covering the story, I've read a lot about other schools and other scandals. You know, University of Minnesota being one of the most, you know, famous of all. You know, Florida State had a pretty bad one with, I think, some kind of online music class. I can't remember what it was, but, you know, let me tell you what, you know, President Ross said at an editorial board meeting, you know, I think it was last week, where he just said, you know, basically he kind of acknowledged, like, you know, what's happened here just kind of shows that Carolina is really not that much different, you know, than other programs, that they're susceptible to, you know, this kind of stuff. You know, just like everyone else. And, you know, but part of the story is the fact that for years, you know, they talked about, you know, the Carolina way and how they could do it right athletically and do it right academically, be successful, and because they did it, you know, they did everything right. And it's, you know, it's just clear that that wasn't the case. And, you know, I'm not sure, you know, what more I can say beyond that.
And finally, there are a lot of folks who, as you have pointed out earlier, who have very strong feelings about this on both sides, perhaps because it is a sports story, and I suspect there are folks who are probably not happy with the fact that I've taken so much of the Chapel Hill radio station's time to talk with the Dan Cain, who the folks who are so ardently in defense of the program right now. What would you say to the Chapel Hillians and those who are so closely identified with Carolina, who are so angry with you for your coverage of the story? You've got a chance. Just would you, if you have something you would like to say to them, this is a chance to do it.
Well, you know, I'm just doing my job. That's simple. I'm just doing my job. I'm trying to go where the facts lead. Dealing with, you know, a very difficult federal law that, you know, makes it almost impossible to get this information. You know, much of this scandal is the result of, you know, information that FERPA shuts down. And, you know, so it's just that simple. You know, but I'm just basically doing my job. You know, and I'll keep doing it. You know, I'll just keep trying to get at the facts and try to talk to people who are, you know, have information and you know, hopefully we'll figure this all out, because, you know, the University of North Carolina, I mean, it's a great university. It's something for, you know, people of the state, to be proud of. You know, a lot of very talented, top-notch, you know, leaders in their field, you know, at this university. And but it doesn't stay a strong university if you don't if you just pretend when there's a problem that, you know, that it doesn't exist. I don't know what good does that do?
Dan, you've been generous with your time today, and I appreciate your taking time to talk to the WCHL audience about these things.
Okay, well, thank you very much.